Imagine buying a high-end, reinforced steel vault to hold your life savings.
Right, like the ultimate totally secure safe haven.
Exactly. You lock your money inside, you spin the dial, and you sleep soundly. But then a few months later, you find out the vault was actually just like a cardboard box painted silver.
Oh man. And the guy who sold it to you, he probably just skipped town.
Yeah, he's completely gone. You thought you bought a physical asset, but what you actually bought was just a promise. And today we're looking at the investments that masquerade as safe havens, but they operate on a completely different set of structural rules.
It's a wild topic.
It really is. But hey, before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel.
They're awesome.
Yeah, they really are. They've got a full Series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. It's essentially the ultimate toolkit to get you across the finish line. So check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
For sure. So welcome in, everyone. We have a very specific mission today. We are conquering the alternative investments unit for the Series 66 exam.
And we need to be really clear right out of the gate here. This is not about rote memorization.
No, absolutely not. I mean, memorizing a textbook definition might get you through, like a high school pop quiz, but the Series 66, they're going to take those definitions, twist them into real-world scenarios, and test if you actually understand the underlying mechanics.
Exactly. Our goal today is to understand the why. We want to explore these products so deeply that you can recall their behavior effortlessly, even under the intense pressure of the actual exam.
Because what makes this specific unit so notoriously tricky is the camouflage.
The camouflage is the perfect word for it, because the investments we're exploring today, they look exactly like traditional stocks and bonds on the surface.
Right, they have standard ticker symbols, they trade on standard exchanges, you log into your regular brokerage app, you type in the ticker, and you just hit buy.
And they sit right there in your portfolio, looking totally normal. But underneath that familiar, comforting exterior, they're governed by entirely different mathematical formulas and, well, legal structures.
So to help us visualize these kind of abstract concepts, we're going to rely on a recurring cast of characters today.
I love these guys.
They're the best. I want you to picture these three individuals because they represent the exact investor profiles and issuer profiles the exam is going to throw at you in suitability questions.
Right. So first up, we have Nervous Ned.
Good old Nervous Ned. He's the overly cautious retail investor. He is biologically wired to be drawn to comforting buzzwords like safe, guaranteed, and principal protected.
Yeah, he's terrified of losing money. But his fatal flaw is that he rarely actually reads the fine print.
Exactly. He buys the marketing, not the math.
Right. And then on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, we have Day Trader Dave.
Dave is our adrenaline junkie. I mean, picture a guy with a six monitor setup, constantly checking Reddit forums. He wants maximum action and maximum leverage.
To Dave, long-term investing means like holding a position until Friday afternoon.
Exactly. He firmly believes he can outsmart the market using these complex, highly volatile tools.
And finally, the man pulling the strings behind the curtain, Banker Bob.
Banker Bob. He represents the slick institutional issuer at a massive Wall Street bank. He writes the rules of these products, he embeds the hidden fees, he packages them up in glossy brochures.
And above all else, Banker Bob always protects his own bank's downside risk.
Always. So keep these three in mind because their interactions are going to be the key to unlocking this material.
Let's start with a product that perfectly illustrates that illusion of ownership we talked about earlier and how Banker Bob uses that illusion to his advantage.
Yeah, let's talk about exchange-traded notes or ETNs.
The ETN is arguably one of the most frequently tested concepts in the entire alternative investments unit. Specifically because it relies on confusing the investor.
It's so sneaky. On the surface, an ETN looks virtually identical to an ETF, an exchange-traded fund. I mean, the acronyms are off by one single letter.
Right, so if Nervous Ned buys an ETN, it trades on an exchange, it tracks an index, its price fluctuates throughout the day, and it just sits right next to his Apple stock.
But the legal reality of what Ned actually bought is vastly, vastly different.
We need to look at the fundamental difference in the legal structure. So what is an ETF? Structurally.
Well, an exchange-traded fund is a legally separated trust holding actual tangible assets.
Exactly. If you buy an S&P 500 ETF, that fund manager literally takes your cash, goes out into the open market, and buys physical shares of Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, and the other companies in the index.
You own a proportional slice of a real basket of stocks sitting in a vault somewhere.
Right. And if the company that manages the ETF goes out of business, the underlying stocks still exist. The trust is completely separate from the manager.
Yeah, compare that to the ETN.
This is the crazy part. An exchange-traded note holds absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all. There is no trust. There are no underlying stocks, no bonds, no commodities.
It is purely an unsecured debt obligation issued by a financial institution.
It's just Banker Bob's bank issuing corporate debt. But instead of paying a fixed interest rate like a normal bond, the debt pays a return based on the performance of a specific market index.
Taking that vault analogy from earlier, buying an ETF is like buying the physical steel vault filled with real gold bars.
Right. If the vault salesperson goes bankrupt, you still have the vault and you still have the gold. The assets are segregated.
But buying an ETN, that is like walking up to Banker Bob, handing him your life savings, and in return, Bob just writes an IOU on a cocktail napkin.
A cocktail napkin that basically says, I, Banker Bob, promise to pay you whatever the price of gold is in exactly 1 year.
That is the mechanical reality of the product. It is nothing more than a promise to pay a return, minus fees, of course.
Of course, Bob always gets his fees. And that leads to a massive structural vulnerability.
A huge one.
Okay, I want to pose a direct question to you, the listener. Think about this for a second. If Nervous Ned logs into his account and buys an ETN that tracks the S&P 500 index, what actual companies does he have an ownership stake in?
Give it a second.
He has zero ownership. He owns absolutely nothing except that cocktail napkin. He owns a promise from Banker Bob's bank.
And this is where the exam will actively try to set a trap for you. So pay attention here. The exam writers know the acronyms blur together.
Oh, they totally do it on purpose.
They will use phrases designed to trigger your memory. If you are reading a question and you see the phrase unsecured debt obligation, I want alarm bells ringing in your head.
Instantly associate that phrase with the ETN and instantly connect the ETN to credit risk.
We really cannot overstate how heavily the Series 66 tests that specific connection. ETN equals unsecured debt equals credit risk.
Because an ETN is just a promise. So the value of that ETN is entirely 100% dependent on the financial health and creditworthiness of the issuing bank.
Right. If Banker Bob's bank goes bankrupt, your ETN becomes a worthless piece of paper. You don't get your money back.
You basically just become an unsecured creditor standing in line in bankruptcy court hoping to get pennies on the dollar.
And we don't even have to use a hypothetical scenario for this, unfortunately. The financial crisis of 2008 provides the ultimate devastating real-world case study for ETN credit risk.
The textbook example is Lehman Brothers.
Yeah. Before their catastrophic collapse, Lehman Brothers was a massive, highly respected issuer of ETNs. They sold billions of dollars of these notes to retail investors and institutions.
And they had ETNs that tracked perfectly healthy standard indexes. They had commodities ETNs tracking agriculture and energy.
Exactly. And when Lehman went bankrupt, the underlying commodities were totally fine.
Right. Corn still existed. Oil was still being pumped out of the ground. The index itself hadn't crashed to zero.
The benchmark was perfectly intact.
Mm.
But the investors who held those Lehman ETNs woke up to find out that Lehman Brothers was bankrupt.
And because the ETN was simply an unsecured debt obligation of Lehman Brothers, the notes themselves became virtually worthless overnight.
The investors lost their entire principal. And it wasn't because of market risk, not because the price of corn dropped, but entirely because of issuer credit risk.
The bank making the promise vanished. And the promise just vanished right along with it. That is the devastating danger of the cocktail napkin.
It really is.
But, okay, hold on. If I'm studying the source material, I notice a bullet point that feels completely counterintuitive given what we just discussed.
What's that?
The material explicitly states that one of the primary characteristics and even a major selling point of an ETN is that it has no tracking error.
Yes.
Wait, how can something that holds zero assets track an index perfectly? And isn't having zero tracking error a massive advantage over an ETF? Because, I mean, ETFs have tracking error all the time.
That's a great question. And it is an advantage on paper, but you really have to understand the mechanics behind it to see the double-edged sword here.
Okay, let's break it down.
Let's look at why an ETF has tracking error in the first place. An ETF has to operate in the real world. If you manage an ETF, you actually have to execute trades. You have to pay transaction fees. You have what's called cash drag, meaning you always have to hold a little bit of uninvested cash on hand to handle daily redemptions from investors selling their shares. And that cash, it isn't earning the market return.
That makes sense. Plus, when the index rebalances, say the S&P 500 kicks out a failing company and adds a new one, the ETF manager has to physically sell the old stock and buy the new one.
Exactly. All of these real-world frictions mean the ETF's actual performance will inevitably deviate slightly from the pure theoretical mathematical return of the index. That deviation is the tracking error.
But the ETN avoids all of that friction because it doesn't actually exist in the physical asset world.
Precisely. Banker Bob isn't buying anything. He doesn't execute trades, he doesn't pay broker commissions to acquire stocks, and he doesn't hold cash for redemptions.
He's literally just doing math on a napkin.
He simply looks at the closing value of the index, subtracts his annual fee, and says, "That is what I owe you."
So because it's purely a mathematical formula unburdened by real-world trading friction, the ETN matches the index return perfectly.
Zero tracking error is indeed a feature, but it is the exact same feature, the fact that they hold no underlying assets, that exposes the investor to that massive issuer credit risk we just discussed.
Wow. The exam loves to test this paradox, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
They will present a scenario where an investor wants perfectly precise exposure to an index with absolutely zero tracking error, and they will ask which product fits that description.
So you have to know it's the ETN, but you also have to be immediately aware of the catastrophic risk that comes along for the ride.
Exactly. Which brings up the question of suitability. Why would anyone ever buy an ETN if they have to take on the risk of a massive bank collapsing? Why would nervous Ned ever touch this?
Well, most of the time, Ned shouldn't touch an ETN with a 10-foot pole.
No, never.
The credit risk alone makes it totally unsuitable for a highly conservative capital preservation investor. But there are a few very specific reasons ETNs exist and why certain investors use them.
One primary reason is accessing incredibly niche, obscure, or hard-to-replicate markets.
Right. Think about a highly complex strategy, like an index that tracks the implied volatility of the S&P 500 using short-term futures contracts, or an index that tracks a bizarre, highly illiquid basket of emerging market currencies.
If an ETF tried to physically replicate those strategies, the trading costs, the bid-ask spreads, and the rolling of futures contracts would create massive, unacceptable tracking error.
The ETF might underperform the theoretical index by 5 or 6% a year just in friction costs?
The ETN solves that completely. Banker Bob just promises to pay the mathematical return of that weird index, absorbing the hedging headaches himself.
There's also a significant tax angle to ETNs, right?
Yes, there is. Because the ETN doesn't hold real assets, it isn't constantly receiving stock dividends or passing along short-term capital gains from internal buying and selling within a portfolio.
Because when you hold an active ETF or a mutual fund, you often get hit with annual taxable distributions even if you didn't sell your shares.
Exactly. But with many ETNs, you don't face those annual tax hits. The taxes are generally deferred until you actually sell the note or it reaches its maturity date.
So for a highly tax-conscious, high-net-worth investor, that structural tax deferral is a major selling point.
It is. But we have to counter that tax benefit with a warning about liquidity.
Oh, definitely.
Yes, ETNs trade intraday on an exchange. You can buy and sell them at 11:00 a.m. on a Tuesday, just like a stock. But they typically have significantly lower trading volume than major ETFs.
And lower daily volume means wider bid-ask spreads. The difference between what a buyer is willing to pay and a seller is willing to accept might be substantial.
So if Ned panics and needs to liquidate his ETN immediately, he might take a significant haircut on the price simply because there aren't enough active buyers on the other side of the trade.
Okay, wait. Let's stop right here. Let's transition from the illusion of ownership over to our adrenaline junkie.
Day Trader Day.
Yes, Dave. Because Banker Bob has created a whole suite of products specifically designed for Day Trader Dave. These are products that use math and derivatives not just to track an index, but to violently supercharge its daily returns.
We are talking about leveraged funds.
The mechanics of leveraged funds are incredibly fascinating, but they represent a catastrophic danger to the uninformed buy-and-hold investor.
The Series 66 tests these heavily because the regulators are absolutely terrified of retail investors treating them like normal mutual funds.
So broadly speaking, a leveraged fund uses complex derivatives like equity swaps, futures contracts, and options along with borrowed capital to amplify the daily return of an underlying benchmark index.
Right. They usually target a multiple of 2x, so 2x or 3x, 3x the return.
So if the NASDAQ 100 goes up 1% today, Dave's 3x leveraged NASDAQ fund goes up 3%. Dave thinks he has found the ultimate cheat code for building wealth.
It looks like a cheat code if you only look at a single day. But there is a massive mathematical trap hidden in the core structure of these funds.
And it revolves around one highly testable, absolute rule.
The daily reset.
The daily reset. This is where long-term investing dreams go to die. We need to hammer this concept home.
These leverage funds reset their leverage exposure every single trading day.
Every single day.
They do not care about the cumulative performance of the index over a week, a month, or a year. Their legal mandate, literally spelled out in the prospectus, is to deliver 2x or 3x of today's market movement, from the opening bell to the closing bell.
Tomorrow is a brand new day, and the fund recalibrates its derivative positions entirely to start fresh.
You know, I actually use an absurd analogy for this, but it perfectly illustrates the math.
Girl, please share.
Think of the romantic comedy 50 First Dates, or, you know, imagine a goldfish with a strict 24-hour memory.
A goldfish managing a multi-million dollar institutional derivatives portfolio. I love it.
That's exactly it. Dave's 2x leverage fund goes to sleep every night at 4:00 p.m. when the market closes. And when the opening bell rings the next morning at 9:30 a.m., the fund wakes up with complete and total amnesia.
It completely forgets what happened yesterday. It doesn't remember if it's up 50% for the year or down 20% for the month.
Right. It just looks at its mandate. I must deliver exactly twice whatever the index does today. And the portfolio managers buy or sell swaps to recalibrate the leverage ratio to exactly 2-to-1 based on that morning's starting assets.
That daily amnesia, that constant recalibration, is the source of a phenomenon known as volatility decay,
which is also frequently referred to on the exam as beta slippage or compounding drag.
Those terms are interchangeable for our purposes, and we need to walk through the exact step-by-step math of this, because the Series 66 expects you to understand the mechanical reason why these funds hemorrhage money in flat, choppy markets.
Let's build a scenario and actually do the math here.
Yeah, I want to walk through a multi-day scenario to really show the decay. Let's say we are tracking a standard boring index, and the index currently sits at exactly $100.
Okay, and day trader Dave buys a 2x leveraged fund tracking that index, and his fund also starts at exactly $100.
Got it. On day one, the market has a fantastic session. The underlying index goes up exactly 10%.
So the index moves from $100 to $110.
Dave is thrilled. His 2x fund does its job perfectly. It delivers double the 10% return, giving him a 20% gain.
So Dave's fund goes from $100 to $120. He feels like a genius.
But on day two, the market gets choppy, the index drops. It drops exactly 9.09%.
And why that specific weird percentage? Because a 9.09% drop on a base of 110 brings the index exactly back down to $100.
Right. So the index started at 100 on Monday morning, went up, went down, and by Tuesday afternoon, it is sitting at exactly $100. It is perfectly flat. It has a 0% cumulative return over the 2 days.
Now let's look at Dave's fund. The goldfish woke up on Tuesday morning with $120 in assets.
It doesn't remember Monday's massive win.
Exactly. It just has to deliver 2x of Tuesday's index return. The index dropped 9.09%. So the fund must drop twice that amount, which is 18.18%.
Okay, listener, put yourself in Dave's shoes. You have $120. You lose 18.18% of it. Where does your account balance end up?
Let them think about the math.
You lost money. If you do the math, 18.18% of 120 is roughly $21.82. You subtract that from your 120 starting point for the day, and Dave is left with $98.18.
This is the critical insight that regulators want advisors to understand. The underlying index did absolutely nothing over 2 days. It went from 100 to 110 and back to 100.
But Dave's 2x leveraged fund dropped from 100 up to 120 and then down to $98.18.
He lost nearly 2% of his total capital in a perfectly flat market. That is volatility decay. That is beta slippage.
And if we extend this scenario, it gets so much worse. Let's say this chop continues for a month. The index bounces between 90 and 110, but at the end of the month, it lands exactly back at 100. It's unchanged. What happens to Dave's 2x fund?
It doesn't just sit at 98. It continues to bleed out.
Right, because every time the fund loses value, it requires a mathematically larger percentage gain just to get back to even.
Losing 20% requires a 25% gain to recover. Losing 50% requires a 100% gain to recover.
So in a highly volatile sideways market, the mathematics of daily compounding act like a slow, relentless leak in a tire. It will bleed the fund dry, even if the underlying benchmark index goes absolutely nowhere.
Which brings us to a major explicit exam trap alert.
Oh, this is where the exam tries to get you.
The exam writers will try to lure you into simple arithmetic. They will present a scenario where a client holds a 2x leveraged fund for an entire calendar year. The underlying index goes up exactly 10% for the year.
And the question will ask what the expected return of the 2x leveraged fund is over that same one-year period.
The trap answer, the glaring, bright red, incorrect answer that looks so tempting, is 20%.
The exam wants you to take the bait and simply multiply 10% by 2.
You absolutely cannot do that. Because of the daily reset, the goldfish memory, and the compounding drag of volatility, a 2x fund held for a year does not deliver 2x the annual return.
Depending on how violently the market chopped around during those 12 months, the fund could be up 5% or it could actually be down 15% despite the index finishing in the green.
So how does this translate to the concept of suitability? Because suitability is the lifeblood of the Series 66 exam.
Right. As an investment advisor, your primary job is matching the right product to the right client profile.
The regulators are incredibly strict on this. FINRA/AWA and the SEC have issued joint investor alerts and enforcement actions regarding these products.
Leveraged funds are strictly designed for short-term trading. They are tactical tools for intraday or multi-day directional bets by aggressive, sophisticated investors who actively monitor their portfolios every single day.
They are wholly, fundamentally unsuitable for buy-and-hold retail investors like nervous Ned.
If Ned reads a prospectus, sees S&P 500, ignores the 3x leveraged part, and drops his retirement savings into it, he is going to get slaughtered by beta slippage over the next 10 years.
Recommending a leveraged fund to a conservative investor for long-term growth is an immediate suitability violation.
Okay, so day trader Dave understands the math, and he loves using the 2x and 3x leveraged funds when he is feeling optimistic about the market.
Right.
But what happens when Dave wakes up, reads a terrible inflation report, and becomes incredibly pessimistic? He is convinced the market is going to crash. Does he just short sell individual stocks? Or does he look at inverse funds?
Well, the structural mechanics get even stranger as we dive into inverse and leveraged inverse funds.
Inverse funds are a fascinating structural tool, but they are deeply misunderstood by retail investors who view them as a safe, simple way to short the market.
Let's start by defining a standard, unleveraged Mega 1X inverse fund.
An inverse fund aims to deliver the exact opposite of the benchmark's daily return. If the S&P 500 goes down 1% today, the inverse fund goes up 1%. If the S&P goes up 1%, the inverse fund loses 1%.
But here is the critical mechanical distinction. They achieve this inverse relationship by utilizing derivatives, primarily swaps and futures contracts.
Right. The fund manager is not going out into the market borrowing millions of physical shares of 500 different companies and short selling them.
No, they are simply entering into derivative contracts with investment banks, like Banker Bob's firm.
And because they are using those derivative contracts to target a specific daily outcome, what underlying mechanism do we have to bring right back into the conversation?
The goldfish memory.
The daily amnesia.
Exactly. This is a repetition of the key concept from leveraged funds, but it is absolutely vital that you lock it in for inverse funds as well. Inverse funds have the exact same daily reset mechanism as leveraged funds.
The portfolio managers recalculate and reset their derivative swap exposure at the end of every single trading day.
That means inverse funds are subject to the exact same volatility, decay, and compounding drag that we just painstakingly calculated.
If the market goes up and down violently for a month but ends perfectly flat, the inverse fund will actually lose money due to the daily reset friction.
And naturally, Banker Bob decided that a regular Manic 1X inverse fund wasn't generating enough excitement or fee revenue.
Oh, of course not.
So he combined the two concepts to create the ultimate danger zone for retail investors, the leveraged inverse fund, the negative 2X and negative 3X funds.
These funds combine the mechanics and the risks of both strategies. They target a magnified multiple of the opposite of the daily return.
Let's make sure the math is super clear here. If you buy a negative 3x leveraged inverse fund and the underlying index rises 1% that day, your fund loses 3%.
That is the mandate.
Right.
And this leads to incredibly fast wealth destruction if you are on the wrong side of the trade. Let's pose a scenario.
Let's do it.
Day trader Dave gets incredibly stubborn. He looks at the charts, decides a massive recession is imminent, and drops a huge portion of his portfolio into a Nana 3X leveraged inverse fund tracking the NASDAQ. But Dave is wrong. The market doesn't crash. Instead, a new technology breakthrough happens, and the market goes on a relentless, multi-month, massive bull run. The index grinds up 1% or 2% almost every day.
Listener, what happens to Dave's negative 3X fund?
It gets absolutely pulverized. It evaporates.
Evaporates is the accurate term. Because the fund resets daily, the losses compound continuously on a shrinking asset base.
If the market goes up consistently, a negative 3X inverse fund can lose 50%, 70%, even 90% of its value in a matter of weeks.
It is financial suicide to use these as a buy and hold hedge in a rising market.
This brings us to another massive exam trap alert regarding suitability and product mechanics.
The exam will attempt to confuse you by mixing up the characteristics of inverse funds with the characteristics of traditional short selling.
You must be able to clearly distinguish between these two strategies. They are not interchangeable, and they operate under different regulatory and financial rules.
Let's do a comprehensive side-by-side comparison. Let's start by comparing their long-term tracking ability. If you execute a traditional short sale, meaning you borrow shares of a specific stock, sell them in the open market, and wait for the price to drop, your return tracks the inverse of that stock's performance perfectly over the long term.
So if you short a stock at $100 a share, hold that short position for 3 years, and the stock finally drops to $50, you buy it back and you make a clean $50 profit per share.
It's a one-to-one relationship, regardless of the holding period.
But with an inverse fund, because of that goldfish daily reset and the beta slippage, long-term tracking deviates massively.
Right. You cannot buy an inverse fund, hold it for 3 years, and expect it to perfectly mirror the inverse of the index. Over a long time frame, the compounding drag breaks the correlation entirely.
The second major comparison point is the logistics of executing the trade.
To engage in traditional short selling, you are legally required to have a margin account approved for options and margin trading.
You are literally borrowing physical shares from the broker-dealer, which involves paying margin interest on the borrowed value.
But an inverse fund removes that barrier to entry. No margin account is required.
You can buy shares of an inverse fund in a standard entry-level cash brokerage account or even inside a retirement IRA, just like you would buy a share of normal stock.
You aren't borrowing shares. You are just buying an equity stake in a fund that happens to hold complex derivative swaps internally.
And the third, and arguably most heavily tested comparison point, the maximum loss potential. When Dave short sells a stock directly, what is his maximum theoretical loss?
It is theoretically infinite.
There is no ceiling. If Dave shorts a company's stock at $10, hoping it goes to zero, his maximum profit is $10. But if that stock gets caught up in a massive Reddit meme stock short squeeze and the price rockets from $10 to $500 to $1,000,
Dave is legally obligated to buy those shares back at $1,000 to return them to the broker.
His losses can stretch to infinity because a stock's price can technically rise forever.
Now compare that infinite risk to the maximum loss on an inverse fund.
The maximum loss on an inverse fund is strictly limited to your initial capital investment.
Exactly. If Dave puts exactly $5,000 into a Netically 3X inverse fund, the absolute worst case scenario, even if the market goes up 10,000%, is that the fund's value decays down to zero.
He loses his $5,000. He will never receive a margin call demanding more money. He will never owe the brokerage a dime more than he originally put in.
Now let's analyze this through the lens of our characters and their suitability profiles. Host, let's play this out.
Right.
If traditional short selling carries this terrifying, theoretically unlimited, infinite risk, and inverse funds have a strictly capped maximum loss where you can only lose what you put in, wouldn't an inverse fund actually be the safer, more appropriate choice for nervous Ned?
Right. If Ned is terrified of a market crash and wants to hedge his retirement portfolio, shouldn't he prefer the capped risk of the inverse fund?
That is a phenomenal trap question, and it feels entirely logical on the surface. Safer max loss means it must be better for the conservative investor, right? Wrong. It is absolutely fundamentally unsuitable for nervous Ned. Yes, it is safer strictly in terms of maximum absolute dollar loss. But if Ned attempts to use an inverse fund as a 6-month or 1-year hedge to protect his retirement account, the volatility decay practically guarantees the strategy will fail.
The daily reset will chew up his capital, even if the market trends downward slightly.
It's like trying to use a scalpel to chop down a giant oak tree. The tool is just wrong for the job.
The inverse fund is a precision intraday scalpel for day trader Dave to use on a Tuesday afternoon. It is never, ever a savings account or a long-term portfolio hedge for nervous Ned.
That is the exact suitability distinction the Series 66 exam will require you to make. You have to look past the surface-level risk metrics and understand the structural mechanics.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground so far. We have seen pure, unbacked promises written on cocktail napkins with ETNs.
And we've seen derivative fuel, daily resetting amnesia bets with leveraged and inverse funds.
So what happens when Banker Bob sits in his corner office, looks at a traditional, boring corporate bond, injects it with a highly complex web of derivative options, slaps a comforting but deeply confusing label on it, and sells it to the retail public?
Oh boy. You get our final major topic, the Frankenstein investments, formerly known as structured products.
Calling them Frankenstein investments is not just a joke. It is the most accurate structural description possible.
Structured products are literally stitched together from completely different parts of the financial markets to create a pre-packaged mutant investment vehicle.
So what exactly is a structured product conceptually? At its core, it takes a traditional security, almost always a zero coupon bond or a standard fixed income note, which is supposed to provide some level of principal protection or steady income.
Right. And it combines it with a derivative component, usually a complex series of call or put options.
The options provide a return that is linked to the performance of an underlying asset, like a stock index, a single equity, or a basket of currencies.
Banker Bob's marketing pitch is essentially, I will give you the safety and sleep at night comfort of a bond, combined with the exciting, unlimited upside potential of the stock market, all rolled into one convenient package.
It sounds like the holy grail of investing. I mean, it sounds incredibly appealing to a retail investor who wants growth without risk.
But as investment advisors, we have to whip the cover off the prospectus and look at the structural reality underneath the hood.
And this structural reality connects right back to the very first topic we discussed today.
Just like ETNs, structured products are almost exclusively issued as unsecured debt obligations of financial institutions.
There is that phrase again, unsecured debt obligation. The cocktail napkin.
Yes. This is Banker Bob's corporate debt. If you buy a structured product that promises a return linked to the S&P 500 and Banker Bob's massive Wall Street bank suddenly collapses due to a liquidity crisis, your money is gone.
The S&P 500 could be up 20% that year. Perfectly healthy, but you are nothing more than an unsecured creditor of a failed bank. You carry full, unmitigated issuer credit risk.
The derivative options inside the product are meaningless if the entity that promised to pay them ceases to exist.
Let's break down the three main types of structured products that the Series 66 loves to use in suitability scenarios. First up, principal protected notes.
Now, nervous Ned hears the words principal protected, and his brain essentially turns off. He instantly falls in love.
He thinks, finally, an investment where my principal is 100% safe, no matter what happens in the stock market.
And that psychological comfort is exactly the trap Banker Bob sets for Ned. The glossy marketing materials put the word protected in massive, bold font. But let's look at the mechanical fine print of how these are actually built.
Okay, let's pull it apart.
Banker Bob takes Ned's $1,000. He uses $800 of it to buy a zero-coupon bond that will mature to $1,000 in 5 years. He takes the remaining $200 and buys call options on the S&P 500.
But there are two massive catches here. First, the protection only applies at maturity. These notes often have a lockup maturity period of 5, 7, or even 10 years.
Which means if Ned panics in year 3, maybe he loses his job or he just gets scared of the market and he tries to sell his principal protected note to get his cash back, there's absolutely zero protection.
He has to sell it on the secondary market, which for structured products is incredibly thin and illiquid. He might only get $700 back for his $1,000 investment.
The protection is a total illusion if you don't hold it to the exact end date.
Furthermore, and this ties back to our core theme, who is actually guaranteeing that principal?
It is not the United States Treasury. It is not FDIC insured like a high-yield savings account at a local bank.
The protection is only as strong as Banker Bob's corporate credit rating.
If Bob goes under in year 4, the zero-coupon bond backing the note defaults. As we mentioned earlier, Lehman Brothers sold billions of dollars of so-called principal-protected notes before 2008.
The retail investors who bought them lost their shirts, completely bewildered because the word protected was literally in the title of the asset.
Let's move to the second major type of structured product reverse convertibles.
If principal protected notes are designed specifically to lure in nervous Ned with the promise of safety, Revus convertibles are engineered to seduce day trader Dave with the promise of massive income.
Reverse convertibles are highly complex, and we need to walk through a concrete mathematical scenario to understand the mechanics.
So Dave loves reverse convertibles. Why? Because they advertise massive double-digit coupon yields.
Dave sees a marketing email for an investment paying a 15% annual yield in a macroeconomic environment where normal, safe treasury bonds are only paying 4%. His eyes light up. He thinks he's found a glitch in the matrix.
But we have to ask the critical why. Why on earth is Banker Bob willing to pay Dave a 15% yield? Bob doesn't just give away money.
No, he doesn't. The answer is that Dave isn't just buying a high-yield bond. By purchasing the reverse convertible, Dave is secretly selling catastrophic insurance to Banker Bob's bank.
Here is exactly how the mechanics of a reverse convertible work. It pays a very high yield, but the repayment of your initial principal at maturity is directly linked to the performance of a specific, highly volatile, underlying reference asset.
Let's use Tesla stock as our example. Banker Bob structures a reverse convertible linked to Tesla stock. He sets a specific barrier level, which the exam will often refer to as a knock-in level.
Let's say Tesla is currently trading at $200 a share. Banker Bob sets the knock-in level at $140, representing a 30% drop. Dave buys $10,000 worth of this reverse convertible.
Let's look at scenario A. The market is fine. Over the life of the note, Tesla stock chops around a bit, maybe goes up to 250, maybe drops to 180, but it stays relatively stable.
It never drops down to that $140 knock-in barrier. What happens?
Dave wins scenario A. He collects his massive 15% coupon yield every year, and at maturity, Banker Bob hands Dave his full $10,000 cash principal back. Dave feels like a genius who outsmarted the bond market.
But let's look at scenario B, the disaster scenario. 6 months into the note, Tesla announces terrible earnings. The stock plummets. It crashes from $200 all the way down to $100 a share.
It has violently breached or knocked in through that $140 barrier level.
So what happens to Dave's money?
The entire mechanical structure of the investment flips on its head. Because the barrier was breached, Dave does not get his $10,000 cash principal back at maturity.
Instead, the terms of the reverse convertible dictate that Banker Bob hands Dave physical shares of the underlying asset, calculated at the original starting price.
So Dave gave Banker Bob $10,000. Bob bought Tesla stock at $200 with it, getting 50 shares. The stock crashes to $100.
Bob looks at Dave and essentially says, "Hey, Dave, thanks for the cash. This stock crashed 50%, and I really don't want to hold this heavy bag of losses anymore. So, as per our agreement, here are your 50 shares of Tesla. They are now only worth $5,000. Enjoy that 15% coupon."
That is exactly how it works. Dave absorbed the entire downside risk of the equity crash.
The excessively high yield was simply his compensation for selling a put option to the bank, taking on the extreme downside risk of a highly volatile underlying asset.
If the stock craters, Dave is the one left holding the depreciated shares. It is the financial equivalent of picking up pennies in front of an advancing steamroller. The yield is great, right up until you get crushed by the downside conversion.
Wow. Okay, the third major type of structured product is the auto-callable note.
These also pay a high contingent coupon yield, but they operate with built-in observation dates, usually every 3 or 6 months.
If the underlying asset hits a certain target level on one of those observation dates, the note automatically gets called away by the issuer.
Calling it away means the investment ends early, unilaterally, at the bank's discretion. You get your original principal back, you get that specific coupon payment for that period, and the investment is completely terminated.
You have to take your money and try to reinvest it elsewhere, which means your upside is strictly artificially capped.
Exactly. Let's say you buy an auto-callable note linked to a massive growth stock like NVIDIA. A month later, NVIDIA announces a revolutionary new AI chip, and the stock goes up 200%.
As an investor, you are ecstatic.
But wait. The observation date hits. The stock is above the target level. Banker Bob calls the note away. You don't get a 200% return. Mm-hmm. You get your initial capital and an 8% coupon, and you were forced to sit on the sidelines and watch the rest of the massive rally happen without you.
You took the risk of holding the asset, but Banker Bob mathematically capped your reward.
He really did.
So let's pause here, because if we look at how Banker Bob is building these Frankenstein products, buying zero coupon bonds, buying call options, selling put options, structuring knock-in barriers, the math feels like it's missing a variable.
Where is Banker Bob taking his cut? He isn't doing all this complex financial engineering for charity.
Right. This brings us to a crucial exam trap alert regarding the pricing and fee transparency of structured products. This is where the retail investor gets quietly, legally fleeced.
When you buy a regular stock or an ETF, the pricing is highly transparent. You see the bid price, you see the ask price, you know exactly what the asset is trading for on the open market, and you see the exact commission the broker is charging you. It is a clear line item transaction.
But the pricing model of a newly issued structured product is totally, intentionally opaque.
Let's say Banker Bob's firm issues a brand new structured product and sells it to NervousNet for exactly $1,000.
Okay.
If you were to take that product apart, lay out the zero coupon bond and the derivative options on a table, and calculate their actual mathematical fair value on the open market.
Right.
The real value of the components might only be $930.
So Ned pays $1,000 for something mathematically worth $930 on day one. Where does that missing $70 go?
It goes directly into the institutional pockets. It covers Banker Bob's internal structuring fees, the complex hedging costs the bank incurs to manage the derivative risk, and most importantly, the massive lucrative commissions they pay the retail brokers who push these complex products onto clients like Ned.
The fees are embedded deep inside the issuance pricing model. Ned never receives a receipt or a line item on his monthly statement that says, Banker Bob's hidden structuring fee, $70. It is completely invisible to the retail eye.
Totally invisible.
Based on the deep dive we just did, listener, put yourself in nervous Ned's shoes for a moment. If Ned is pitched a structured product, is he getting a highly liquid, transparently priced asset that protects his money?
Let them answer that one.
Absolutely not. He is getting a highly illiquid asset that he can't easily sell before maturity, plagued with invisible embedded fees, burdened with an artificially capped upside, and carrying the full, unmitigated credit risk of the issuing bank.
Understanding those structural flaws brings us perfectly to the synthesis of this entire unit. Because on the Series 66 exam, you aren't going to be tested on these products in a vacuum.
The exam writers will give you a dense client scenario and ask you to choose between these products or identify the specific risk of one versus another. We need to lock in how to tell them apart when the pressure is on.
Let's run through a rapid-fire, side-by-side comparison of the concepts that candidates confuse most often.
I'm ready. Let's build the mental decision trees.
First matchup, the ETN versus the ETF. If you were reading a long, convoluted question and the text specifically mentions the phrases unsecured debt obligation, issuer default, or credit risk, what is the only possible answer?
The answer is absolutely the ETN, the exchange-traded note. It is the cocktail napkin promise.
But if the question describes a legally separated trust holding underlying physical assets or a basket of securities, then we are definitively talking about an ETF.
Second matchup, leveraged and inverse funds versus traditional buy and hold index funds.
If the question scenario describes an investor like Nervous Ned wanting to hold an asset for 6 months, a year, or an entire market cycle to capture long-term macro growth,
you eliminate the leveraged and inverse funds immediately from the multiple choice options. Recommending them is a suitability violation.
If the question mentions daily reset, beta slippage, or compounding drag, it is explicitly testing your knowledge that these funds are intraday or short-term tactical tools only.
The goldfish memory destroys long-term returns. Day trader Dave can use them on a volatile Tuesday. Nervous Ned should never touch them for his 10-year retirement plan.
Final matchup, structured products versus direct equity investment.
The exam question describes an investment where the upside participation rate is capped at 80% of the index's return. There is no active secondary market making it hard to liquidate before a 5-year maturity date. And the initial pricing model includes opaque, unlisted structuring costs.
That is the textbook definition of a structured product, the Frankenstein investment. Capped upside, severe illiquidity, and embedded hidden fees.
If the investor simply made a direct investment in an S&P 500 ETF, they would enjoy unlimited upside participation, high daily intraday liquidity, and total transparent fee visibility.
Let's pull back from the specific definitions for a moment and look at the philosophy of the exam. Why do you think the Series 66 examiners, the state regulators, and FINERA care so deeply about this specific unit? Why dedicate such a massive portion of a licensing exam to these obscure alternative products?
If we unpack this from the perspective of an investment advisor representative, which is the legal fiduciary license this exam grants you, it comes down to human psychology.
These products are incredibly dangerous in the real world because they prey on the biological impulses of retail investors.
Investors like Nervous Ned are drawn to comforting, hypnotic buzzwords like principal protection or no tracking error. They hear the word protected, their analytical brain turns off, and they assume it's as safe as a treasury bond.
And on the other side, adrenaline junkies like Day Trader Dave are drawn like moths to a flame when they see 15% yield or 3x daily returns.
The retail investor sees the glossy marketing brochure. They don't see the underlying mathematical formulas.
And as an investment advisor, your legal fiduciary duty, your strict ethical obligation, is to be the mechanic who looks under the hood. You have to be the one who actually reads the 200-page prospectus.
You have to identify the unsecured credit risks of the ETN. You have to calculate the daily reset compounding drag of the leveraged fund. You have to spot the massive embedded hidden fees in the structured product.
You have to protect Ned from his own crippling fear of the market. And you have to protect Dave from his own rampant greed by determining the true structural suitability of the asset.
The regulatory bodies know from historical data that these products cause massive, devastating retail losses during market downturns. They test you rigorously on the mechanics because they will not hand you a license until they are confident you won't blindly sell a 3x leveraged fund to a grandmother.
As we bring this deep dive in for a landing, let's solidify this knowledge.
I want to do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways from the Alternative Investments Unit. I want these three core concepts etched into your memory for exam day. Takeaway number one, exchange-traded notes.
ETNs are unsecured bank debt. They carry full, unmitigated issuer credit risk. If the bank fails, the ETN goes to zero.
They have zero tracking error, but that is simply because they hold no actual physical assets. They are purely a mathematical promise to pay a return.
Takeaway number two, leveraged and inverse funds.
These derivative-driven funds reset their leverage exposure every single trading day.
Because of this daily amnesia, they suffer massively from volatility decay, also known as beta slippage, or compounding drag in flat or choppy markets. They are strictly designed for short-term tactical trading and are wildly, fundamentally unsuitable for buy-and-hold retail investors.
Takeaway number three, structured products.
These are Frankenstein investments that combine traditional zero-coupon bonds and complex derivatives into a single unsecured debt obligation.
They carry high, opaque, hidden costs embedded in their issuance price. They suffer from severe illiquidity if you try to sell before maturity. They often cap the investor's upside potential, and they carry the full issuer credit risk of the structuring bank.
We have covered a massive amount of technical and conceptual ground today. But before we sign off, we want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over as you continue your exam preparation and eventually enter the industry.
Think about the broader ecosystem of Wall Street. If FINRA, the SEC, the state regulators, and every major consumer protection body have issued multiple explicit warnings that these alternative products are dangerous, highly complex, mathematically flawed over the long term, and fundamentally unsuitable for the vast majority of buy-and-hold retail investors.
Why do massive financial institutions like Banker Bob's firm dedicate thousands of hours and millions of dollars to designing, manufacturing, and heavily marketing brand new versions of these products every single year?
What does that relentless innovation tell you about where the real risk-free money is actually being made in the financial industry?
That is the kind of question that shifts your perspective. From a student memorizing facts to a true professional understanding the mechanics of the market.
I highly encourage you to take all this knowledge, apply it to those cert fuel practice exams, and absolutely crush the Series 66. You have the tools, the analogies, and the mechanical understanding to look under the hood now. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into alternative investments. Goodbye and happy studying.